Hello, welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources in how to live a more courageous life. We look to assist you on your hero's journey in any way that we can. Truth is our compass, humanity, our tribe. Welcome and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. One of my favorite sayings is that each chapter of your hero's journey will require a slightly different version of yourself. And it's a saying with many layers, isn't it? I was speaking with my 18-year-old son, Lucas, who has taken a fairly cynical view of his future prospects. He doesn't think that there's any way he's ever going to be able to buy a house or get ahead. It's the hamster wheel perspective. And it's totally justified, by the way. It's just not the most creative way to look at the future. But he's really young, right? And I was telling him that he is on Lucas Rizak version 2.0 or 3.0 right now. I'm his father and I'm on Tony Rizak 9.0 or 10.0, and I'm getting ready for another version soon. I went on to say that the way you see yourself in the world changes with each version, sometimes subtly and sometimes quite drastically, and you can always tell when you're outgrowing the previous version of yourself. How? Well, you might start getting tired of the same old you and the routine you do. You might find yourself annoyed at how you see and do things. You notice that things aren't working, but you don't yet have the next moves. Oftentimes, what is required is a lighter version of yourself. And when I say lighter, I mean lighter in ego, lighter in attachment, lighter in the emotional, spiritual things that are weighing you down. Things like a lingering addiction or a victim mentality that no longer serves you, or a habit that's completely running you around. Or maybe you keep telling yourself the same two or three disempowering stories about yourself and the world. You know the ones where people around you know that you're lying to yourself and don't know how to alert you. Are you following me? In many ways, you may not even be fully aware that you've started a new version of yourself. It might feel like you're just working through another mini crisis, or you finally turn the corner on some part of your life that you've been struggling with. Or maybe your friend circle looks a lot different, like mine does now. The friendship circle of Tony version 10.0 looks a lot different than the friend group of Tony in earlier versions. This doesn't mean you have to create new close friends, just that it may be required to successfully grow into what is needed from you. Today's guest is a wonderful example of growing into newer versions of yourself and traveling lighter on the road less traveled. I found her to be inspiring and charming. Enjoy the interview. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is Christy Stevens. Christy is a mother, a former addict, and now a champion of recovery and helping young people find a better life path through her work with the Eastside Academy. Here is my interview with Christy Stevens. Okay, I am here with Christy Stevens, mother and recovery champion and advocate for the Eastside Academy. We're going to talk all about that. Christy Stevens. Christy, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It is great to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you so much, Tony, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you know, I had the pleasure of sitting across the table from you at the Lincoln Day dinner. So we got to know each other a bit then. And then you and my wife did a little bit of work with the Eastside Academy. You were gracious enough to include my wife in that. So I've got to know you a bit and I started to hear some of your story. And it just really resonated with me on a bunch of different levels that we're going to talk about. And my listeners know I'm a huge fan of the hero's journey, and you've certainly got a really wonderful hero's tale about your own life journey. But I guess just before we get into all that, just give the listeners a sense of who you are, like where you grew up, where you live now, family, and what you do for work currently.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so I actually, I grew up in, Eagle River, Alaska. And, I was just sharing with someone earlier today about some fun stories around that, but that was, I didn't know it then, know it now, a unique experience, growing up fishing the Kenai River and, tying my own flies and running from grizzly bears and, really loved growing up there. It was wonderful. And then now I live in Lake Stevens, Washington, which is just outside of Seattle. And I work at Eastside Academy, which is a nonprofit alternative high school that helps young people that are struggling in many different ways to find their footing and graduate from high school. And we support them in many aspects. And so it's I'm passionate about the work that I get to do. And it is something that is in alignment with my own story.
That's great. You ran from grizzly bears in Alaska.
I did. I was in between a grizzly mama and her grizzly babies. And I didn't know it. I was like 11, just minding my own business. I had caught my limit of salmon and I was going to go show my dad my catch. And I was dazing off, looking into the river, looking for pretty rocks. About age 11. And I hear my dad yell from the bridge nearby, Chris, run. And I look around and I'm like, so I grab my fish, of course, which is probably 60 pounds of salmon, and I'm dragging him along beside me. And he says, drop your fish. And so I say, no, I'm not dropping my fish. I was so proud of him. But I finally did. And then I made it to my dad up on the bridge. And luckily, the grizzly bear mama stopped and ate the salmon.
So yeah, the dropping of the salmon was the key move there, I think.
Right? I was not going to, but I did.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you and I, we both have addiction and recovery in our life story. I've spoken of mine on many occasions, as I've had both doctors on that are specialists in recovery, and also just fellow addicts that have been around the track and recovered. And they're some of my favorite people in terms of hero's journey. And I guess my first question, I guess, is just, when did you first notice maybe that you weren't like some of your other friends, or maybe you were like your other friends? Like, I think when I was young, I think I surrounded myself with a lot of people that liked alcohol. And I just did it subconsciously. So when I looked around, it just looked like I was just one of the guys. There wasn't anything unusual, but I had no healthy people really around me to compare it to. So I guess, that's my first question is, when did you first start to go, you know what, maybe I'm not like everyone else? Or when did you first start to notice as a young person, maybe that you were going down a different road than maybe you thought you might?
Yeah, well, I can say I know that even the first time that I drank was definitely noticeably different than anyone else around me. Mm. We were actually out on a camping trip up in Alaska, and my cousin and I had found a beer. So sometimes the fishermen upstream will, their coolers will topple over, and the contents of their coolers or their tackle boxes will come floating down the river. And so we found a Bud Light floating down the river, and we were like, oh, should we drink it? You know? So anyway, we did. And then we thought, you know what, we're going to go back up to camp, because all of our family, you know, would go fishing and drink booze, mostly Bud Light and maybe some whiskey or something of that nature, mm-hmm. Or tequila. And so we went back to camp and proceeded to sneak Bud Light from the cooler, because we thought we'd do more, because we thought that was fun. And my cousin, I don't think continued on. I think I went and got the bottle of tequila that was on the picnic table, and I poured some of that into my Bud Light can. Yeah. And I was going to keep drinking because I really loved the feeling that I got when I was drinking. And the reason I loved it so much was because I had a really hard beginning of my life, where I was born into an abusive situation and was abused for the first years of my life. And that came with a lot of shame and a lot of, I don't even know, but I experienced the world in a very difficult way and really didn't like myself very much. And so when I started drinking, I noticed relief, and I noticed that I felt better, and I wanted more of that feeling. And so that even in initial instance, I drank to get drunk because, well, I just drank until oblivion, really. I wasn't necessarily intentionally trying to get drunk, but I didn't want to stop. And that was the first time. And I would say, you know, different high school parties and things like that. I was the cheerleader and, you know, going to parties. yeah, I didn't stop at three, you know, ever. So,
yeah.
Yep.
Yep. That sounds very familiar to me. Well, and then how did it progress, your addiction? Like, did it, cause yeah. for me, it's like, I tried a lot of different things, but really it was alcohol was my drug of choice. It was the addiction in my family that was the most prevalent. You know, I like cigarettes too. And yeah, there's a stage where I really loved cannabis, you know, even though they say that's not addicting. I was like, well, I used it like an addict, you know? Yeah. And I certainly tried a lot of different things, and it was just probably God's grace that I didn't get hooked into something that was, you know, like heroin or you know, there wasn't any fentanyl back in our day, right? It was crack and heroin and cocaine and stuff like that. But so for me, I kind of stayed in my lane of addiction. But it was brutal. Like, it was like I was just, you know, barely functioning. What yours progressed though. You didn't just stay with the Bud Light and the tequila. You went far and wide, right? Yeah.
I did. Yes. Yeah. So while we lived in Alaska, I was fairly sheltered. There was weed, pot, and I knew people that tried it or did it. And I tried it at different parties and different social encounters, but I really hated the way it made me feel because it was more of a downer. And I actually felt fairly paranoid, even though I didn't really know it at the time, but it wasn't a positive experience. And when I would do that in conjunction with alcohol, I just went from 0 to 100 and, you know, would get sick to my stomach. So I didn't really like that either. So that wasn't for me. And until I moved down to what we call the lower 48, you know, I hadn't been exposed to more hard drugs. I'd never seen white powdered drugs, which is what we called it. So when we moved down to the lower 48, you know, I finished high school and went to college at University of Idaho, where I continued to party. I was in a sorority, but I didn't make it past the first year. So when I moved back home with my parents and decided, okay, I'm going to get a job at Costco. That's what we thought would be a good choice. And so I did that. And when I did that, you know, again, joining the party crowd, I made a friend and we got an apartment together. And she invited over her boyfriend who brought with him methamphetamine. And so probably 4 a.m. maybe is when he pulled that out one night when we were partying and we had drank. And that night I did do a little pot, which I didn't normally do. So I was pretty out of my mind. And they brought that out and said, you know, let's do this. And really were pressuring me. You can do it, do it, do it. And I was like, no, I've seen the after school specials and I know that's going to make me hemorrhage from the nose. So I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And then, so, you know, plying me with more alcohol. I don't know why they wanted me to do this so bad, but they did because I think it's because everyone else was doing it. And so finally they say to me, if we do it and we don't bleed from the nose, then you won't either. And I thought, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So they went first and sure enough, they didn't bleed. And so I did it. And I was so instantly addicted. I loved the feeling. I didn't feel, I don't know, maybe there was a sense of powerlessness. So there was a sense of not good enough, which I think we as humans all can struggle with. And sure. A lot of us do still, but yeah. That was gone. And I felt like, literally I said the words, I feel like I'm on top of the world. And I loved it. And so I was that girl, that cautionary tale where they say you could try it once and become hooked. And I did. Yeah. So I went from being, you know, just sweet Christy that was trying to figure out her way in the world to, you know, a liar, a cheater, a thief. Like I was going to do anything I could to continue to feel that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, that is, you always kind of think it's a little bit of an urban myth that you could use something one time, right? Mm-hmm. But yours is the living proof that it could be that immediate. Like it's the dopamine is exactly the right key for the lock for you to be like, oh yeah, let me just keep doing more of this. This is all I really want to do now.
I didn't want to do anything else. And it blew like ruts in my brain, I'm sure, which I learned later about like kind of the neuroplasticity. But and that was the thing that was going to make me feel the way I felt I needed to feel.
So then how many years were you basically using at this like yay, this is my thing? Like, was it like 5, 10, 15? Like, how long were you basically in the throes of this kind of harder drug addiction where it's like you're not really thinking about trying to get out, you're just like looking for your fix? Was that a long time or?
Well, there were many rounds of in and
Yeah.
out. My first round went about a year, and I went straight to the point where I was hanging out with the meth cooks, and all the high-ranking drug people, because I was a pretty girl, and they just wanted me around, and so and I could get it for free, and so I went in pretty hardcore right away for about a year until my parents got wind of what was going on, and they came and swooped me up, packed what they could of mine in a garbage bag or two, and then we went and dropped me off at a treatment center. So that was a year, and I came to a Seattle treatment center, 28 days and a wake up, and that worked for about a year. I got a sponsor. I did all the things I was supposed to do. And for about a year, I stayed clean and sober. Met a guy in treatment, which we all know how that goes. Ended up, getting engaged. And, my family, the men in my family are all in construction. And so he was a construction worker, and it just seemed like that made sense. But I ended up relapsing. About a year in, when I realized I didn't actually want to be with him, and for whatever reason, that meant I should go get some alcohol and start
Oh yeah.
drinking.
So when you got sober, it was from you basically did cut from everything, right? It was no alcohol, none of that. You're just like, I'm just gonna go clean and sober out of
Absolutely.
yeah,
Yes.
of course. Yeah,
Yeah, I
okay.
can't do anything. I if
Yeah.
I do one thing, it's right back into the I want the full experience of the high.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next time that maybe you went into rehab, I'm curious is because your parents did they did the mediation and put basically the intervention and put you into rehab. Was the next time also an intervention, or were you basically at that point navigating your own, you had your own compass and you're like, you know what, I'm gonna have to stop this again. Was it on your own volition, or was it, did your parents again come back to you and say, okay, we're noticing this behavior, we want to put you back in here?
I was, from my memory, which is fairly hazy, I was back out and running. Oh gosh, my total time in massive addiction, I would say, is about 18 years. And there may the next point in which I know that I tried to get clean and sober was when I became pregnant. Then you have a new life inside of you, and so it's okay. I always wanted to be a mom, and I always wanted to have that experience. Of course, certainly the lifestyle I was leading didn't lend itself to that. And so I was going to do everything I could to try to get clean and sober, and become the mom that I wanted to be. But 18 years, probably not 18 years at that point, but maybe over a decade of running that lifestyle and then becoming pregnant, it's not quite so easy to stop. And so that was the next intervention. I would say that was, a kind of a God intervention, of course. That would be the next point. And I ended up going to a treatment center that you could, because CPS got involved and had taken my little one. So I was going to do everything I could to try to get her back. And so that led me to a treatment program with like moms and kids, where you can, get sober and try to get your little one placed back with you.
Yeah, it's when you're going through what you went through, like I look at all of the addiction in our city right now. Like, I live in North Seattle. There's a lot of housing for addicts nearby. There's a lot of drugs on Aurora. It doesn't look like people want to get off, like I think part of it is people feel helpless because they so want to help these people, but the people don't want the help, or they have to be ready themselves. What would you tell like a younger version of yourself now that you're a mother and you've got all this wisdom and you're really sharp and you're smart. And I hear your story and I'm like, I look out there and I go, any of these people could turn it around.
Yeah.
Right. But I think because the canvas I'm looking at is there's so much desperation and addiction and mental illness, and I can't separate one from the other.
Yeah.
That it just looks hopeless. And I understand some people like, just give them a place to live, have some compassion.
Yeah.
But I look and I go, well, like, some of them might make it out of this to have like constructive lives. Like, look at you. Like, there was probably no way to predict you were going to do that. I mean, sure, the people that knew you in Alaska or the people that knew you in your sorority in college probably would have been shocked by your descent, but not maybe by your redemption. They might have been like, well, no, I always thought she was going to turn out to be this and this. Is there people out there on the streets that are in the same situation where it's like they're literally that close to maybe turning it around? You know, like I know I'm giving you a whole lot of stuff. I just, as a citizen of Seattle, it's just like, it's so depressing in a way. And yeah. I don't know. We don't seem to be winning this in any way, shape or form. And it's just, I feel so terrible for these lives that are just, they're just drifting in this addiction.
Like I see it too, for sure. And, an entry point in which I could see some sort of, system-wide intervention that could be beneficial and was beneficial for me. So there's a lot more to my story that we haven't really touched on, but at one point, I'm in and out of jail for sure. Mm-hmm. There's a point in your addiction where you, if you go down far enough, you are either going to, for women and probably for some men, you're either going to end up selling your body or you're going to end up selling drugs to support your habit because you can't keep a job. You can't have any income any other way. And you're just going down and down.
Yeah.
And so because of the abuse I had withstood as a child, I was not going to turn to selling my body. So I chose to try to sell drugs. I've always been a bit of an entrepreneur, but it did not work out well for me. I'm not a very low profile person. And so it wasn't long before I certainly got in trouble with the law and had some drug charges going on. And what I could say to that is that if we took people with anything drug related or, addiction related, and we, I don't know, and this is just a, for what it's worth, it could go any which way.
A thought experiment.
So we take these people and we, myself, I don't mean these people as though I'm not one of these people. People who are in this situation and we say, okay, your first infraction, immediately 90 days incarcerated. And we take those 90 days and it's not incarcerated and you're locked in a cell. It's incarcerated and you're going to go through this 90-day treatment program.
Yeah.
And then you're released. And then maybe we do that three times. Maybe it's a three strikes, you're out. Okay. The third time, you're going to do some hard time, something of that nature where, we're exposing people, whether they like it or not, because you've got, an audience that can't really leave, right? What do they call that?
Captured.
A captive audience.
Captive
right?
audience. Yep.
And so we've at least exposed them to these things three times. And so at that point, there is, in recovery that once you know about it, your using isn't the same.
Exactly.
You can't unknow it. So it changes things. So, whether they like it or not, they haven't really chose it, but they've chose it because they've broken the law. And it's actually an act of grace to put them through something, to put us through something that could change us. And so, something of that nature, and then maybe there's options for, a housing situation with accountability. But there's a, there's a journey, there's a path towards healing, and not everyone will take it. And, but it will be an opportunity instead of just, kind of a penal, consequence. So
it's a great idea. I think people might be surprised at the number of people that actually took to the recovery by being, because they're forced into this treatment program because they broke the law.
Yeah.
I have a feeling the numbers would be pretty good. I mean, you know, maybe not as high as say 50%, but not as low as like 5%. I think somewhere in there, I think a lot of people that are in the throes of addiction, they just don't have the means because they're using drugs. So they're spending all their money on their substance. So they can't even think about that. And it's like to have to go through the shock treatment of like, I can't get my substance. I actually have to attend these groups and people are in here telling the truth about their addiction. Yeah. Oh shit. You know, here we go, you know, and I think it would really help. I think it's a really good idea. I'd love to see more people embracing that. You know, I have told people, and I'm interested to get your thoughts on this. You know, I wouldn't be who I am today if I did not recover from my alcohol use and my addiction and attended meetings and spoken about it openly. I'm super grateful for the whole thing, the disease, the shortcomings, the shame, like I had to go through all of that to be able to speak more authentically. And I feel like I represent a tribe that has, and you're the same way. I represent a tribe that has addicts, or they're charming, charismatic people, you know, a lot of times, you know, so they're good storytellers and they're all, they have all these gifts and they have this Achilles heel that they lean into. But I'm just overall, like, I'm super grateful that I've been able to tell people the story and tell other people's story about it, because I feel like it gives permission to anybody that might be listening that might be like, you know, I'm so sick of using. And here these two are, and they're chit chatting like it's, you know, it wasn't a walk in the park, but they did it. And they're actually grateful for their addiction because it taught them so much. You know what I mean? And so, I just wanted to give you a chance to just, you know, comment on that. Like, what was the learning curve for you? Like, once you turned the corner on your recovery and in your rearview mirror, what does your addiction look like now in terms of the medicine that you learned or the lessons that you learned?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I am just like you in that regard, where I am so grateful, for who I am today. I'm so grateful. I love the person I am today. And that was a very long journey. And there are still times in which, I have to fight the urge to think that, oh gosh, I don't deserve this wonderful life that I have, which is such a lie. But the person that I am today and the life that I've lived has gotten me into places and conversations with people that have been transformative for them and for me to be able to be a part of that transformation, even if it's just a tiny, conversation, or if it's longer, where I'm able to play an active role in the very thing that your podcast stands for, which is, you know, the betterment of humanity and for, you know, truth and freedom for people. And that's a sacred space. And I get to be invited into that because I do live in a space that is authentic and vulnerable. And I'm not really worried about what anyone thinks of me in regards to sharing about what happened then and who I am today. And so, there's an incredible amount of gratitude. And then also just being able to lead by example and live the life that I live for my two girls that I have, that daughter that I gave up for adoption. Oh, I didn't really share that piece of my story. I did get that daughter back that we talked about earlier. And then I had to give her up for adoption because I kept coming in and out of addiction because being addicted to methamphetamine. And then ultimately I was on methamphetamine and heroin injecting. Mm-hmm. It leads you to a life that I knew, thank the Lord for a moment of clarity where I knew if I didn't give her up, like, she may not survive, you know, like I couldn't lead her in the life that I was living. So I did give her up, but it was an open adoption. I have been in her life and in communication with that adoptive family all through her life. And just got word 2 days ago that she's 16 now. And she, I believe, is going to come live with me. So, and she wrote me a little card, maybe 2 weeks ago, where it said, you inspire me and you make me want to be the best version of myself. And, without living the years of addiction and overcoming that and really valuing the things that I do today and what really matters in life, I don't know if I'd be the kind of mom that I am today or for that. And so, man, there's so much grateful gratitude in my heart for my journey, I guess I would say.
That's so great. Yeah. I mean, it shows too, your story shows that it's never the chapters that come later, like they can be really full of promise and love and all of the things that maybe you wanted earlier in life before you got onto the substance and the dopamine hook, you know. And like you said, I think a lot of people maybe they have been traumatized by their childhood or their something happened. And so the addiction becomes this salve where they can, they don't have to deal with this issue yet. You know, maybe I don't ever have to deal with it if I just keep using, you know? And so you get this, you become like somebody that runs from the truth. You run from the elephant that's trying to get your attention right there. And because we're not equipped to tell the truth about things when we're young and maybe never, you know, but I just so appreciate your courage in telling your story. And it to me, it shows that, you know, you can have a pretty rough role in many chapters. And I know people that have corrected course like late in life, you know, in their 60s and 70s, all of a sudden they wrote this chapter that nobody was expecting, you know. And I was talking to my son the other day, and you know, they're young. My son's 18 and his friends, and you know, I hear them talking about, you know, the crack addicts down the street. And you know, I don't say anything to embarrass my son, but when I talk to him in person, I'm like, look, those people, you're starting to lose your humanity. I know you're really young. Mm-hmm. I go, but those people, all those people that are bent over after they just shot up and all those people, I go, I want you to do a little experiment in that. Imagine them as 4, 5, 6 year olds, like none of them. This was not their dream. Not one single one of them was dreaming about this. They had other dreams that they wanted for their lives, and they've been massively sidetracked. And some of them are going to pull out of it. I know it looks like there's no way they're ever going to pull out of it, but some of them will. And so it's like to keep that open. I think adults maybe do a similar version of like, oh, those people that made bad choices, never recognizing that sometimes we make choices that we're not conscious of constantly, right? And so I don't know. I just wanted to comment on that we continue to give people the benefit of the doubt, and that we never know when they might see the light, that they might have a come Jesus moment where they literally find the Savior and God. And it can happen in a flash for people. I've seen it many times. And so just that we keep that flame alive so that people, you know, people don't condemn others for their addiction, I guess is one way to say it, right?
Yeah. I have a little story about that very thing. So, you know, after you get back on track in life and you're in recovery and, you know, life is going well. And then we start to see those people on the streets. And sometimes, you know, I remember, I was probably 7 years into recovery or something of that nature. And I remember thinking like, why can't they get it together? Like, what's going on? And this was just, we commute a lot in Washington and Seattle. Yep. And so I started to have that thought, and I caught myself and I said, what am I thinking? You know, of course I was that person at one point, and but I did start to go down that path, and I thought, Lord, please let me never, you know, I said a prayer and I said, Lord, please let me never start to be hardened in that way or start to think that way. And he gave to me, pray for them. So every time I drive by someone and I notice them, I say a prayer. I'm like, Lord, help them find you, help them find their way. And it's just a simple prayer. And you know, my gosh, you're praying it a lot if you're driving on certain roads. But what a beautiful place to be. And then now I have a 6-year-old daughter, you know, in sobriety and in recovery, been remarried. I have a little daughter, and she asks questions about them. And we go to church. That's how, you know, we view and experience God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was like, what's wrong with that person? Or, you know, they look like they have a dark spirit. And I said, yes, Esther, and we should be praying for them. So now we pray for them. And so she'll bust out into spontaneous, you know, prayers out loud just for someone on the side of the road that I may not even see. Just Lord, help them find you. Lord, help them find their way. And ask questions. So I do the same thing with my little one. It sounds like that you're doing with your son and the way that you do. And yes, we do have to keep the flame alive, because man, everyone had written me off many, many times. And you just don't know when it's going to be that moment where it's going to get different for somebody.
Exactly. I love that, Christy. You know, you're a advocate and you work for the Eastside Academy. I'll give you a chance to talk about where people can find that and what kind of work. But I just wanted to read the mission statement because I just think what a beautiful mission statement they created at the Eastside Academy. So it says, our mission is to inspire change in the lives of youth through high school education, counseling, recovery, housing, and life skills in a Christ-centered environment. I just think that's a fantastic mission. So what kinds of things do you do at the Eastside Academy? What are they working on right now? And how can people, lastly, how can people find the Eastside Academy and support you?
Yeah, so I'll say it now, and then hopefully you'll remember to say it at the last of what I, after I share just a bit. You can find us at eastsideacademy.org. And we are an alternative, as you said, an alternative high school set in a Christian environment. And we have small class sizes. So our students, they're not all in recovery. And I'm going to say 80 to 90% of them don't even believe in Jesus. That's like not something that has to happen. But Eastside Academy was started by some teachers that were partnering with some other organizations in the community, some 30 years ago, give or take, to start to meet the need of students that were falling through the cracks. And it was actually on the East Side, which many people think on the East Side, there's no need there, but there is. And so they founded the school and it kind of went through ups and downs and people deciding that, you know, funds needed to go elsewhere. And so what happened was these teachers said, you know what, no, we're going to stay and we're going to try to figure this out. So they kind of planted their flag in the ground. And then they started the Eastside Academy and did, you know, were very resourceful to get the things they needed together to support these students. And so we actually are located in Bellevue on the property of Bellevue Presbyterian. People call it Bell Pres. They have generously donated a wing of their building and two homes right there in the center of Bellevue, which is not cheap, to Eastside Academy. And so we have students come to us from all different walks of life and reasons and even areas that, you know, greater Seattle area and beyond will serve students who are just not thriving. Maybe they're behaviorally expelled from school. Maybe they're addicted to substances. Maybe they're having self-harm or, you know, eating disorders, or maybe they're just, their parents passed away when they were young and they have anxiety in a large school structure. It's just not working for them, but they're really smart. Or, you know, the list goes on. So it's just, it can be any of these students, whether they have means or they come to us through CPS because their parents have abandoned them. That's kind of the scope of the students that we serve. And so I love them and we get to know them pretty one-on-one because we have, we can max out at 50 students. We currently have, gosh, I'm going to say between 20 and 30. Would love to see that grow. We would love to serve more students that are struggling in the ways that I've described. But what we provide is we provide high school education, small classrooms, credit recovery. So if you find that you've, you know, whether COVID or whatever it was that you dropped out and you have a lot of classes to make up for, we have a teacher that says, designated to do credit recovery with students, and that can be one-on-one or whatever. And then we have counseling. So we offer each student weekly counseling. We offer each student recovery support. All of our students go through recovery, and whether they have substance abuse issues or not, they still go through the recovery classes because we believe that everyone has something they're recovering from. Everyone has in life can benefit from the tools that recovery classes can teach. So, and that's been beautiful to watch. They also receive mentoring. So we have a mentorship program. So anyone out there that's interested in mentoring a high school student, please get a hold of us. We would love to have one of our students benefit from a mentor. We really are passionate about that, walking alongside these students. And then we have the lastly, but not leastly, the housing options. So, you know, students, whether they, again, come to us through, you know, the foster system or CPS or something like that, we have a girls' house and a boys' house, and they are homes and they have house parents, and our house parents have little ones, actually, in both houses. They both have little ones. So it's very much like being in a family if you're in the houses. And we surround them. And some of these students were their family. And we do require that all students before graduating, they go through senior seminar. And in that class, they apply to college. So we get them to a place where they have everything they need to be able to apply to college. And we support them in writing their essays. And we have various colleges in the area come in and speak and visit and help them with what they need in order to be able to successfully apply to colleges. All of the students that graduate Eastside Academy have been accepted into college. Whether they decide to go to college or not is their choice, but we want to make sure they know that college is an option. And so that's something that's really beautiful. If our students fall below 80% GPA, they go into something called study tables, and that's a one-on-one tutoring, credit recovery type situation. And we always want our students up at the 80% or above. And so our students do graduate with pretty good GPAs. And so coming from a place of you know, really hard life experiences that we wouldn't wish on anyone, to a place where they graduate knowing that they are cared for and that God loves them, whether they choose to believe in God or not is their choice. And that there is a way to move beyond what life has been, and that they can chart their own path to success. And we want to make sure that we elevate them to be able to do that. So when I share this, many people will say that sounds too good to be true, or, oh my gosh, how do you do that? We are 96% private funded, which means there are individuals in our area who donate to us to provide us with the means to offer such services. And we couldn't be more grateful for that. My heart is to see something like Eastside Academy in every major city one day. That would be the prayer of my heart, because I feel like had I had some sort of, you know, intervention or something like that, you know, even in high school, I know I wasn't really bad then, but I might have made some different choices if I'd have had some intervention with some of the stuff that I was struggling with internally. And so that's who we are, and that's what we're doing. And
That sounds like a great program, man. So many great things about it, you know. And that's, you said that's at eastsideacademy.org is the website for that. So people can go check that out.
Absolutely. Eastsideacademy.org.
Beautiful. Well, Christy, thanks so much for coming on Basecamp for Men. I so appreciate your time and your story. You're just a wonderful storyteller, and just so many layers to it. And just always, pro humanity, pro God, pro forward movement. I just appreciate humans that have overcome things like you have, and have you know, medicine and things to share with the village, and look to uplift everyone. So I just love your story. I love what you're about and what you're doing with Eastside Academy. So keep up the great work. And thanks again for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tony, for having me. It's been a real joy. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. To find and support the great work that Christy and Eastside Academy are doing right here near Seattle, go to www.eastsideacademy.org. Thank you, Base Campers, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors, and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.